You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now for the Deep Dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a Deep Dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP. Again, that's Nick A. ESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin. And this week's deep dive is actually a little different. I had the chance to sit down with Jack Miller and have an interview with him for a good 20, 30 minutes. And I apologize, the audio may sound a little different. We were in his office. I was using excellent recording equipment, but I was not in studio with Mr. Miller. Now, if you're not familiar with Mr. Miller, he is the president and CEO of the Quill Corporation, which became the nation's largest independent direct marketer of office products and employed over 1,300 people with annual sales in excess of $630 million. Now, in 1998, Quill was acquired by Staples, and Mr. Miller went on to found multiple corporations, including the Jack Miller Family Foundation, as well as the Jack Miller Center. Now, this is an educational organization that teaches constitutional law and theory at some major universities nationwide, such as Harvard, Yale, Stanford, and a whole bunch of others as well. And so it's an excellent organization. And the reason why I wanted to interview Mr. Miller is because you have not been paying internet sales tax because of the efforts of Mr. Miller and his family through the Quill Corporation all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court as they fought for internet sales tax and how that would impact it. And this has recently come back into light because the site Wayfair has once again gone in front of the United States Supreme Court to defend this position with different results. And I'm not going to get into that because we get into that a bit in the interview with Mr. Miller, but it is absolutely fascinating. And he's going to talk a little bit about his center, which I think just seems like an excellent institution and organization, as well as that Supreme Court case. And we're going to dive into a little bit of technology, but please enjoy this deep dive with Jack Miller, former CEO of Quill. So Jack, thank you for taking time to meet with me today. I know you are a very busy man, and I really appreciate the time. And from what I understand, you have a new book that you are publishing right now. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it's a book about something that's I've been involved with for the last 14 years. I've invested a lot of money and time in the program, and now I'm writing about it. 14 years ago, I started a center for the teaching of America's founding principles and history on college campuses. And it's called the Jack Miller Center. And over these 14 years, starting from basically zero with a lot of pessimism in the air as to whether we could do it, we now have 900 professors on over 300 campuses across the United States, including some of the biggest ones around.
Yeah, wow.
So University of Texas, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, places like that, plus a lot of small liberal arts colleges. Well, during that time, the main thrust of what we have is a summer institute, the base of our program. We have a lot of programs, but the base is a summer institute where young postdocs come, about 25 at each summer institute. We have two a year. And they're taught by the best professors in the country in the field. And it's been my pleasure to be at most of those, in fact, every one of them for some times. And I've participated in them, I've read the materials, I've had discussions with the young professors and the older professors, and I've learned a lot. In college, I was strictly business. I never had any liberal arts programs. or at least any that I can remember, and certainly didn't study the American founding in any detail. So during these past 14 years, I've learned a lot, and of course I read a lot of books in addition to the summer institutes. And so the Miller Center asked me to write a book, and I wrote this book, Born to Be Free, where the first section of the book is my understanding of what the American founding is. The understanding that our mission statement is in the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the pursuit of happiness means the ability to improve your position in life. Unlike the old feudal system in Europe, you weren't born and die, and you didn't die in one position. In our mission statement, whatever you're born, you're equal before the law, and you have the ability, through your own efforts, to improve your position in life. So to me, that's the keystone, and that's the mission statement. Like most mission statements, it hasn't been fully realized yet, but over the years we've come closer and closer. The Constitution is simply the document that forms the best type of government to help realize that mission statement. So everything about us and our country is based on the individual and the individual's ability to rise or not rise and to control his destiny. So that's what the first book is about, the first part of the book is about. My understanding of what America is about, what our founders wanted America to be, and the dangers and, you know, the possible pitfalls, etc. Then the second section of the book is about the Miller Center, what we're doing. The college level programs, what we've done there. We've got a high school initiative now where we're teaching high school teachers, civics teachers, how to teach this to their students. We have National Constitution Day where the government said that there must be, I think it's October 17th, must be a Constitution Day recognized on college campuses, any that receive federal money, which is most. And not much was being done about it, so we sort of took it over, and we're getting more and more programs onto campuses all the time. And we help young professors. We not only have the summer institutes, but we help them in their careers. So they get onto tenure-track programs. So we're there all the time. And because there are not a lot of professors on campuses who want to teach, the teaching of America's founding principles had been kicked off of campus ever since the 60s, to the point where less than 5% of the campuses had programs on it and were teaching it. So we keep our professors together in a network so that they can have support from one another. They can, one in one university can call somebody in another university who he met at the Summer Institute, and he could say, hey, I've got this problem, or I'm thinking of doing this, what do you think? So they reinforce one another. We've also become part of the American Political Association of professors, and we present at their programs. So we are continuously and quietly expanding our programs every year. And we make sure that when donors want to donate to universities for this type of a cause, that their donor intent is observed. We oversee the donation, we oversee the university. We only let them dole out money on a yearly basis so that we can see if the university goes off track, they don't get money the next year, etc.
Well, let me ask you this then regarding the foundation and also the first part of your book in terms of how you see you know, America and let's say the dream of what America is, unalienable rights, all that. Because my show is primarily based in technology, how do you think things like the internet or mass communication, now social media, have been able to, you know, further advance your cause, or even further advance the cause of, you know, the Constitution?
Well, several things there. Number one, we have a website that has a tremendous amount of information on it. Has not only what we're doing, but has lectures by professors. We're building up a bigger and bigger library of that, so students or teachers could refer to that section of the website and listen to lectures from the best professors in the country, people like Gordon Wood, who is a preeminent historian in America today, and many other professors like that. Then we also are developing or starting to develop an online program for this, and so that's going to be important.
And is that available to students or the general public, or
It will be available to everyone, but it's in the development phase right now.
Okay.
But other professors have programs online like that. The internet is a good tool for researching all of this type of thing. You can find out anything. Mm-hmm. I use it all the time if the question comes up. The other night at dinner, a question came up and somebody said something was in the Constitution. I said, wait a minute, I don't think so. Boom, we went to the Constitution and you can look at it.
Right.
It's technology is going to do a lot, and of course, it's going to change how universities operate also.
Mm. And you're noticing that in your center as well.
Yeah.
I'm assuming by demand, possibly. I mean, if you're building up a course or a curriculum that's going to be online, then I have to imagine there's a pretty solid demand for that, not just on campus.
Well, there is. We get a demand from other people, from donors. Of course, in this day and age, for example, if somebody is thinking of donating money, they want to look up and see who they're donating to. And if they come to our website, they can see all of the things we're doing, all the progress we've made. They can see our financials. It's a wonderful way to be able to check things out.
Indeed, indeed. And not to jump gears here a bit, but I know that one of the things that, you know, we'd wanted to talk about today was actually the new sales tax online and the internet. And the reason being is that Quill, the corporation you founded, was very heavily involved in a Supreme Court decision years ago to make sure that we didn't have to pay internet sales tax. And now that is being challenged in a case called South Dakota v. Wayfair. And what ran through your mind when you heard the Supreme Court ruling on South Dakota versus Wayfair?
Well, I was somewhat amused to start with.
Okay.
In 1992, when we went to the U.S. Supreme Court and won that case, that they couldn't tax businesses that didn't have a nexus, a presence in their state.
Right.
It was quite a battle. It cost us over $1 million to go from the lower courts up to the Supreme Court and to win that case. And my brother Arnold led that charge. At the time, we had tested it out by starting to charge tax on some states where we didn't have a presence, and it didn't affect our sales at all. So we weren't concerned about the sales. We were concerned about the fact that there are 10,000 taxing entities in the United States. Some will tax gum, some won't tax gum. Okay, some consider it a food, some don't consider it a food.
Interesting.
And so county by county, metropolis by metropolis, there's different taxing laws. So back then, of course, and even today, it's pretty difficult to keep up with all of these things because they keep changing every day.
Well, the tax code alone is thousands of pages, you know.
Yeah, right.
It's very difficult.
So, but we did test it. We found it didn't affect sales. And we made a proposal to the states at that time that if they came up with one tax, for all the states, all the different districts, whatever it is, 5%, 6%, whatever it is, and then we would collect it, and then they could distribute it to the various taxing entities. Mm-hmm. That would make it simple for the sellers, mm-hmm. and it would be fair for the states, but they turned it down. So for 19 years, they didn't, more than 19 years, 92, 26 years.
Yeah, 26 years.
For 26 years, the states didn't collect any sales taxes mm-hmm. from out-of-state sellers. Mm-hmm. So now they're going to do it. Now, it's not going to affect the sales, okay? The major reason that I and many other people shop online is number one, selection. Mm-hmm. And then number two is price. Well, the price right. is not the sales tax difference. Mm-hmm. I mean, the retailer has a big overhead on his store. So that's not the issue. So what I thought of when they overturned it this year mm-hmm. is, my God, there's going to be a lot of very small sellers who are going to have problems.
Right. Well, if they have to figure out tax for 10,000 different...
Right.
You know, do you think that like an Amazon... Because a lot of small sellers online use like an Amazon or a Walmart as their platform... Yeah. And do you think an Amazon should be the one to handle something like that, as opposed to leaving it to the small retailer who's going to have no idea what to charge in, you know, Poughkeepsie, as opposed right. to Chicago, as opposed to wherever? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are that in our free marketplace, as long as the government leaves us alone and doesn't put restrictions on, I think that it will get figured out somehow, but in the meantime, there's going to be a lot of small sellers who are going to go out of business.
Hmm. Yeah, that is a very real possibility, you know, that we're seeing. Now, if Quill, instead of Wayfair, was actually fighting the Supreme Court right now, or rather was in the decision, so basically South Dakota versus Quill as opposed to South Dakota versus Wayfair, might your arguments about the nexus have been different in the light of growth and expansion of internet and online resellers? Because right now, obviously, in 92, the amount of online retail is significantly less than what it is now. Anybody can open up a shop, like you just said, and, you know, put a shingle out.
Our arguments would be the same. It's the same question of the difficulty of doing this, and the fact that the states did not have control over the out-of-state sellers. They weren't providing us with much service. Their argument was, well, we've got the roads, you're using the roads for the trucks that are delivering the product, etc. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the argument would be a heck of a lot different right now.
Okay, so, and in that vein, one of the opinions of the majority is the nexus rule appears to provide for, quote-unquote, judicially creating a tax shelter. What is your take on that point of view?
Well, look, many states have a law that said that if you haven't paid sales tax, you have to pay a use tax. You know, many people, I don't do this, I pay a sales or use tax on anything I buy, but many people will buy something and have it shipped to their home. They buy from one state, have it shipped to their home, and they don't pay a sales tax in the state they bought it, and then they don't pay a use tax at their home state. So, yeah, in a way, it's a tax shelter for some. Mm-hmm. You know, it happens.
Okay. Fair enough. Do you have any other opinions on this entire South Dakota versus Wayfair ruling?
Now, the only opinion I've got is if my brother Arnold were still alive, he would be dancing to see over the years as this went on, and kept seeing the Quill name, Quill versus mm-hmm. South Dakota. Was it North Dakota or South Dakota?
South Dakota versus
South Dakota.
Right.
In the newspapers over and over and over again. Funny thing is that we sold our company to Staples, and Staples had stores in every state, so they had to collect sales tax.
Yeah. Interesting.
They were very much against what we had done.
Well, I don't think they bought you because of that, right?
No, it had nothing to do with that.
And so, jumping gears once more, just as a former leader of a rather large corporation in Quill, what's your take on the state of cybersecurity today? You know, we hear about large data breaches all the time. I mean, what do you think the future looks like for companies like Quill or larger, Staples, for example, when it comes to having such a large online presence?
Well, let me start off. We have a family office here, and we have a real estate business here.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have our philanthropy office here.
Mm-hmm.
We have three people working in the IT area.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the major focuses that we have is on security.
Mm-hmm.
They just made me change my password, and they got a very complex password now. We're trying to protect ourselves the best way we can.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important. I don't understand it all. I know that a lot of people are always trying to break into websites or into various sites.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a constant battle to keep ahead of them. Not, you know, we hear about the Russian government doing this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we're going into everybody's sites and, you know, our government, but I don't know. It's going to be a threat. It's going to be a continuing threat. You're going to have to keep working like hell to keep safe.
Yeah, it is a nonstop job. I can I can tell you that from personal experience. Now, as you know, the government has a lot of regulatory bodies and compliances and all that, and they also have a lot of that for data security. What do you think the role of government should be in terms of, let's say, data security and compliance for large corporations like a Quill? Are they too heavy-handed? I mean, is it something that we need more of because we have a huge problem with hacking right now?
Let's start with the idea that you said the government has a lot of agencies, and the agencies are passing a lot of rules.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Those rules have the force of law. Those agencies report to the president. In effect, the president is making law.
Mm-hmm.
When our country was set up, one of the protections, our founders gave us two protections. One is the separation of powers in the federal government. The other one was federalism, what the federal government can do and what the state governments can do. Mm-hmm. What the people can do. So in our country today, the presidency has taken over a great deal of the job of the legislature.
Through executive decisions?
Executive decisions and through these agencies who are passing regulations.
Okay.
So the president is ruling by law, is making law, and that is wrong. You've shifted too much power into one hand.
Okay.
Keep going that direction, you'll have a dictatorship. So I think that all belongs back at the legislature, where they should pass laws in regard to what's being done. The president's job is to enforce the law. So the president's job is to make sure that what the legislature passed is being enforced. So if you ask me, right now our country's on the right track by rolling back all kinds of regulations. And I think that that's important. It's freed up business. We're becoming more prosperous as a result of that. And I think it's something that has to go on. Now, I think that this issue has got to be addressed, but it should be addressed by the legislature.
Thank you. Now, is there anything else that you'd like to say as we wrap up this interview?
No, I think that I've lived a terrific life. I've enjoyed what America has and has afforded me. I was in high school during the Second World War, where patriotism was in the air, and I grew up in a country like that, and I'd like to see the country get back to that hurry.
Fair enough. Jack Miller, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now for the tip of the week. And if you have an idea for a tip of the week, I am all ears. I'm more than happy to entertain anything. You can find me at Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP, or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com, and I'm more than happy to give you a shout out here for your tip of the week. Let's begin. And this week's tip of the week is on two-factor authentication, or multi-factor authentication, or multi-step verification. It goes through a lot of different names, and while there are some specifics to each, two-factor authentication tends to be the name that we just apply universally to all of this, kind of a blanket term, if you will. Now, if you're not familiar with this, you may have some of this in your life, primarily through your bank. When you log into your bank with your email address and your password, you might get a text message with a code or an email with a code, and then you have to copy and paste or type that code in, and the code's only good for 10 or 20 minutes, and then it lets you in. That is your second factor of authentication. As a hacker, if I'm able to steal your username and your password, I am not going to have that code that is going to be sent to you via text or via email unless I'm into your text messaging or your emailing. And so the reason why we're bringing this up is that pretty much everybody has two-factor authentication, and how we apply two-factor authentication should be understood. Now, traditionally, we have used text messaging or SMS messaging as the way we get our two-factor authentication for most things. So again, we get that text message. But now, because SMS hijacking is so easy due to infections on Androids and iPhones, it is no longer recommended that we are using text messaging for two-factor authentication or email, because email hijacking is rather prolific. And thank you so much for tuning in this week. It was another fun show, and I think we covered a lot of really good stuff, and I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a really good time, and I hope you keep tuning in. Thank you very much for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza. And if you have any comments, suggestions, questions, absolutely anything, once again, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP. Again, that's Nick A. ESP. And you can always send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. Don't be shy. I love the feedback. We've been having a great time with the show. And as always, stay safe and stay online, everyone. Thanks for listening.